On the evening of December 16th, 1773, a crowd gathered at Boston's Griffin's Wharf, despite the frigid temperatures. They'd come to protest the presence of three East India Company ships, all carrying cargoes of tea. For a city full of caffeine junkies, this was odd behavior. Somewhere between 50 and 200 men approached and boarded the vessels under the cover of darkness. Most were disguised, rather unconvincingly, as Mohawk Indians. Over the next 3 hours, they broke open and threw overboard 342 chests, equal to about 45 tons of tea. It was all bloodless, and the fake Mohawks even tidied up before leaving. It was later dubbed the Boston Tea Party. As an act of overt resistance to British rule, it was a critical step towards the American Revolution. 16 years later, on July 14, 1789, another crowd gathered outside Paris's Bastille on a sweltering afternoon. Whipped into a frenzy by agitators, the thousand-strong mob demanded the surrender of the old fortress, which had long been used as an armory and a prison. The building was already slated for demolition. The Bastille's commander refused to surrender, though he had only 100 men. The mob attacked. Barely 3 miles away, 5,000 royal troops heard the gunfire, but made no effort to intervene. Around 5:30 p.m., the Bastille's defenders threw in the towel. In the ensuing violence, 7 prisoners, including 2 lunatics, were set free, while the commander and several of his men were murdered. The French Revolution had drawn its first blood. These 2 events were the opening acts and upheavals that would transform America, France, and the world. And they were largely the handiwork of secret societies. In the American colonies, the group most responsible was the Sons of Liberty. It first appeared in Boston around 1765 in response to new British taxes on the colonies. The Sons became a kind of franchise spreading throughout the colonies. Sons of Liberty members organized resistance, even physical attacks, against royal authorities. After 1776, the organization acted as a shadow government in British-controlled areas. But the Sons were the spin-off of an older, more important, and familiar secret order, the Freemasons. It might surprise many that Great Britain's East India Company had actually reduced the cost of tea in the colonies. So much so that American smugglers, who made a killing evading royal duties, faced being put out of business. 2 future revolutionary luminaries so affected were Samuel Adams and John Hancock. There were Sons of Liberty members and Freemasons. But not all Masonic brothers approved their actions. 2 other American Masons and future revolutionaries, Benjamin Franklin and George Washington, were appalled by what they regarded as vandalism. Franklin even thought the East India Company should have been reimbursed for its loss. This points up the big danger of generalizing about Freemasons. Despite all the boilerplate rhetoric about brotherhood and loyalty, Freemasons were as likely to end up on opposing sides as the same ones. For instance, at the Revolutionary War Battle of Yorktown, Freemason Washington was ably assisted by French Freemason Marquis de Lafayette and Prussian Freemason Baron von Steuben. But opposing them was English Freemason Lord Cornwallis. Washington, the greatest hero of the Revolution, was a Mason, but so too was its greatest traitor, Benedict Arnold. So Freemasons definitely played prominent roles in the American Revolution. But did that mean that they instigated or controlled it? Did they infuse it with a Masonic agenda? Was the new United States a Masonic republic? Finally, was there something else hiding among the Freemasons, like the Illuminati? Let's take a closer look and see what we find. The American and French revolutions basically started over the same issues, taxation and representation, but took very different courses. In France, the ball first got rolling in May 1789, when France faced national bankruptcy. The crisis was partly caused by King Louis XVI's financing of the American Revolution. This state of affairs forced Louis to summon France's long disused consultative assembly, the Estates General. Two of the estates, the clergy and nobility, represented only 2% of the French population, but they held more than half of the assembly's seats. The third estate, basically everybody else, naturally thought this grossly unfair. Instead of finding a solution, the Estates General ignited a revolution. As the revolution progressed, radical groups took more and more control. The most important of these radicals, the Jacobins, first appeared in late 1789 as the Society of the Friends of the Constitution. The Jacobins would later usher in the year zero, abolish traditional religion, and initiate a reign of terror. The storming of the Bastille is usually portrayed as a spontaneous attack on a hated symbol of royal tyranny. It was anything but spontaneous. 3 days before the assault on the Bastille, King Louis dismissed his liberal finance minister, Jacques Necker. While this might or might not have been a plot by Louis to restore royal authority, that's the way it was spun by agitators in the Palais Royal in Paris. The Palais was a popular area of stalls, shops, and coffee houses considered a hotbed of Masonic activity, and for good reason. The Palais was owned by Louis-Philippe, the Duke of Orléans, the most important Freemason in France. He was master of the powerful Grand Orient Lodge and brother of the influential Neuf Sœurs, or Nine Sisters Lodge. Founded in 1776, the Nine Sisters Lodge is an important link between the French and American Revolution. Its motto was Truth, Union, and Force, which had a slightly prophetic and slightly ominous ring. Louis-Philippe, Duke of Orléans, was also the king's cousin. But Louis-Philippe was no friend of King Louis. The Duke dreamed of sitting on the throne himself as an enlightened monarch. He'd even changed his name to Philippe Egalité, Philip the Equal. At the Bastille, the mob carried his bust around like an idol. And the radical orator whipping up the crowds was the Duke's Masonic brother in the Nine Sisters, Camille Desmoulins. Firebrand Desmoulins was a protege of another prominent Freemason, Count Mirabeau. All three would end up joining the Jacobins. One student of alternative history, Graham Hancock, speculates that the Duke of Orléans and his friends had organized a shadow government in waiting at the Palais Royal. That's probably going too far, but the notion isn't wholly far-fetched. They certainly did plenty of plotting. Two American revolutionists, Benjamin Franklin and John Paul Jones, were initiated as members of the Nine Sisters Lodge in 1778. And Franklin introduced at least three other Americans into its circle, Thomas Paine, Thomas Jefferson, and John Adams. Paine and Jefferson probably joined, but that's not certain. The great French hero of the American Revolution, the Marquis de Lafayette, was yet another Nine Sisters brother. The notion that Freemasons played a pivotal role in the American Revolution has a long history. It's been further popularized by the popular film National Treasure, starring Nicolas Cage, and its sequel, Book of Secrets. Again, it's not a question whether there was a Masonic influence on the Revolution, just a question of how much. I've personally heard a 33rd degree Scottish Rite Mason proudly and publicly proclaim that Freemasons founded this country. Not helped, but founded. And he didn't make the boast at a lodge meeting or in a bar, but at a commissioning ceremony for U.S. Navy officers. Attending that same ceremony was a third-degree Master Mason who felt his Scottish Rite brethren statement was perhaps an exaggeration, though not wholly inaccurate. The population of the American colonies in 1776 was something over 2.5 million people. Out of that number, roughly 750,000 were adult males. Factoring out slaves and indentured servants, 500,000 or more would have been eligible for Masonic membership. Surviving lodge records are spotty, but the number of colonial Freemasons was probably no more than a few thousand. Many started the initiation without finishing. Others dropped out, and some moved from one lodge to another or held multiple memberships. Regardless, Freemasons were a tiny minority in the colonial population and not evenly distributed. Still, history is made by active minorities, not by majorities. So a small number isn't necessarily an insignificant one. It's probably no coincidence that the capital of the revolution, Philadelphia, was home to at least 2,000 Masonic brethren, meaning that about 1 out of 5 eligible males was a member. Despite lots of talk about brotherhood and equality, American Freemasonry wasn't egalitarian. Membership was pricey, and deliberately so. Lodges attracted the upwardly mobile and well-to-do. Masons were far more likely to be literate and well-educated than small farmers and working men. Thus, lodges were filled with men who already occupied positions of influence and already saw themselves as hereditary or natural leaders. But while they were an elite, they weren't a unified elite. Freemasonry first took off in the colonies in the 1730s. This coincided with a bitter schism in the Mother English Grand Lodge. The split pitted the more free-thinking and more political faction known as the Moderns against the more traditional and religious ancients. But all American Masons, whatever their camp, swore an allegiance to King George. Thus, Patriot Masons violated their oath when they turned rebel. Curiously, while King George III wasn't a Mason, both his father and his heir, George IV, were, along with almost every male British sovereign since. If George III had been a fraternal brother, would that have changed anything? Of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence, 9 were indisputably Masons. The actual number might have been 15, and some put it as high as 21. That's equivalent to anywhere from 16% to almost 40% of the Declaration's signatories. Among 39 signers of the Constitution, 13 were confirmed Masons, and perhaps another 15 were too. That's 33% to 70%. Among the generals of Washington's Continental Army, 33 of 74 were confirmed Masons, including the future president, and another 8 maybe were. That's 45% to 55%. So none of these groups was exclusively or even mostly Freemason. But by any estimate, the brothers were disproportionately represented among the revolution's founders and leading officers. Lodge members included many of the most prominent names among the new republic's leadership, including Washington, Franklin, Paul Revere, John Paul Jones, Thomas Paine, Ethan Allen, and John Hancock. Still, does that translate into Masonic control? Something often pointed out as evidence of a secret Masonic agenda in the American Revolution is the Great Seal of the United States. Special significance is attributed to its reverse side, which features an incomplete pyramid topped by a radiant, all-seeing eye. This is commonly interpreted as the eye of God or providence, but there are many meanings. Some claim it's the ancient Egyptian eye of Horus. Masonic and occult scholar Manly P. Hall argued that the eye was the symbol of the esoteric orders and that the pyramid represented imperfect and incomplete human society. These symbols, Hall said, were brought to America by secret societies 150 years before the Revolution, i.e., in the early 1600s. In this, Hall might have been referring to another secret order, the Rosicrucians, but that's not clear. Still, he insisted there was no question that the Great Seal was inspired by these mysterious orders and set forth the purpose of this nation. Between 1934 and 1935, another Freemason, American Secretary of Agriculture Henry Wallace, convinced President Franklin Roosevelt, also a Freemason, to put the Great Seal in the dollar bill. Why a Secretary of Agriculture should make that recommendation is itself an interesting question. To Wallace, the eye symbolized the Masonic great architect of the universe. Its position at the apex of the pyramid was said to represent the destiny of the United States to assume leadership among the nations in inaugurating the new order of the ages. The reverse seal's Latin motto is Novus Ordo Seclorum Annuit Coeptis. The first part translates as New Order of the Ages, which some equate, rightly or wrongly, with New World Order. Annuit Coeptis is trickier. Often rendered as May God favor our endeavor or something similar, it really makes no mention of God, but simply means enterprise. Anything else is inferred or imagined. Or maybe the meaning depends on your level of initiation. The Great Seal is also commonly believed to have been designed, or at least inspired, by Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson. Along with John Adams, they formed the first committee tasked with designing a seal. Of these three men, only Franklin was definitely a Freemason. However, none of their proposals ended up in the final version of the seal. Instead, its creation took a half dozen years and three committees. And consultants did most of the design work. One of the most influential was Francis Hopkinson. Another Freemason, Hopkinson was well acquainted with the unfinished pyramid motif. He'd already put one on a $50 bill issued in 1778. And it's a dead ringer for the one on the seal. Some argued that the appearance of the all-seeing eye on the seal inspired its use in Masonic imagery, not the other way around. They insist it never appeared among American Masons until 1797, 15 years after the creation of the seal. Not true. The eye symbol was used by a Boston lodge as early as 1772. It can also be found right on George Washington's Masonic apron given to him as a gift by Lafayette in 1784. Then there's the story that the design of the Great Seal came from a mysterious cloaked man who simply handed it to Jefferson and disappeared. The tale is doubtless pure bunkum. What it really tells us is that nobody was really sure where the details of the seal came from. Alleged Masonic influence also crops up in the layout of the new capital, Washington, D.C. One Masonic publication hailed it as the world's foremost Masonic city. The man tasked with the job, Pierre L'Enfant, was indeed a Freemason. So was his chief surveyor, Andrew Ellicott. L'Enfant was a French officer who, like Brother Mason Lafayette, came over to fight for American freedom. L'Enfant laid out D.C. streets in a diamond pattern that formed triangles and pentagrams. It doesn't take much imagination to picture the Capitol building squatting like an all-seeing eye at the top of a pyramid formed by Maryland and Pennsylvania Avenues. A more blatant example of Masonic influence was the laying of the Capitol cornerstone in 1793. George Washington officiated, decked out in full Masonic regalia, surrounded by fellow Freemasons. So was this a civic or a Masonic ceremony? Or did they make a distinction? It's worth noting that the first proposal for Washington's monument was a pyramid. What he ultimately got was something akin to an Egyptian obelisk. And Egyptian imagery had significance not just to some Freemasons, but to other secret societies as well, such as the Rosicrucians. Masonic influence didn't end with the Revolution, of course. At least 14 presidents, 37 Supreme Court justices, and countless senators, congressmen, diplomats, bureaucrats, and soldiers would be lodge brothers. Public concern about Masonic influence sparked a national backlash in the 1820s, starting with the disappearance and presumed murder of a dissident Mason in upstate New York. This so-called Morgan Affair, named after the victim, Captain William Morgan of Batavia, New York, gave rise to a national anti-Masonic party. It declined after the 1828 election of Andrew Jackson, who was, you guessed it, a Freemason. Freemasonry also exerted a profound influence on the religious leader Joseph Smith, who'd grown up in New York. he not only joined the Brotherhood, but incorporated Masonic symbols and rituals into his new Mormon faith. And Freemasonry wasn't the only secret society active in the Revolution or in the fledgling Republic. I earlier mentioned the Sons of Liberty. After the creation of the Republic, some of the Sons morphed into dissident Democratic or Democratic Republican societies. Washington believed they harbored dangerous elements. Dissident Sons helped to ignite at least one abortive uprising, the 1794 Whiskey Rebellion. The heavily Masonic Continental Army officers created their own exclusive hereditary organization, the Society of the Cincinnati. Washington was a member of that, too. No one better represents the public and clandestine links between the American and French revolutions than Benjamin Franklin. Popular culture has turned him into an eccentric grandfather with a penchant for kite flying. The real Franklin was a philosopher, scientist, statesman, cunning conspirator, and lifelong secret society adept. Franklin was active in France from 1776 to 1785, raising money for the American Revolution and helping to bankrupt France in the process. He recruited the Masonic military experts Lafayette and von Steuben. While Franklin's Masonic connections don't explain all his success, they undoubtedly helped. When he was initiated into the important Nine Sisters Lodge in Paris, he also participated in the Nine Sisters initiation of his friend, the church-hating philosopher and darling of the future Jacobins, Voltaire. Play word association with French Revolution, and probably the most common response you'll get is guillotine or beheading. Fairly or not, the Jacobin Reign of Terror has come to symbolize the French Revolution in the minds of many. The inventor of the guillotine, Dr. Joseph Ignace Guillotin, was, wouldn't you know it, a Freemason, and a member of the Nine Sisters Lodge, and a Jacobin. The Jacobins deserve some further explanation. They had their roots in a secret association of politicians from Brittany. These men shared membership and to some degree ideology with other quasi-secret societies that sprouted like mushrooms in the revolutionary ferment. Those included the so-called Society of 30, which counted Lafayette as a member, and the ultra-radical Club des Cordeliers, to which our rabble-rousing friend Camille Desmoulins belonged. The Jacobins finally got their name when they set up shop in an old Dominican monastery in Paris. The Dominican monks had been called Jacobins because they were associated with the Church of Saint-Jacques. All simple enough, though some still detect a sinister odor. The name Jacques also belonged to the last Grand Master of the infamous Knights Templar, Jacques de Molay. De Molay was put to death through a conspiracy of the French Crown and the Catholic Church in the 14th century. Later, de Molay and the Knights Templars were adopted as martyrs by many Freemasons. So some inevitably suspected that the name Jacobin was a thinly disguised homage to de Molay. More than that, some suspected that the Jacobins' hostility to the king and church were part of a long-cherished secret plan of revenge. One of those was publisher Nicolas Bonville, who was himself a Jacobin. Radical Jacobins were certainly obsessed with de-Christianizing French society and replacing the Catholic Church with a cult of reason or cult of the supreme being. And some see this supreme being as identical with the Freemasons' great architect of the universe. Many Jacobins were Freemasons, the Duke of Orleans, Desmoulins, Count Mirabeau, and Jean-Paul Marat, to name but a few. But again, not all. The bloodiest of the lot, Maximilien Robespierre, a champion of the cult of the supreme being who presided over the terror, might or might not have been a Masonic brother. Jacobins were split by bitter ideological and personal rivalries. The two main factions were the relatively moderate Girondins and the more radical Montagnards. Their relationship was similar to that of the Russian Mensheviks and Bolsheviks. Robespierre was a Montagnard, a radical. When he and his faction took control in 1793, they launched a purge of the Girondins. Mason slew Mason. Louis-Philippe, Duke of Orléans, the would-be Masonic monarch, lost his head. So did rabble-rouser Desmoulins, along with many more. American Tom Paine only narrowly avoided the blade. Soon, two books appeared alleging that the French Revolution was nothing less than a Masonic conspiracy. But behind this supposedly lurked a more insidious secret society, the Bavarian Illuminati. The first book was written by a refugee French priest, a Jesuit no less, the Abbé Augustin Barruel. In his memoir illustrating the history of Jacobinism, Barruel argued that the French Revolution was the end result of subterranean warfare waged by secret societies to destroy the church and the monarchy. Barruel particularly blamed Masonic philosopher Voltaire for fomenting hatred of Christianity, and Illuminati founder Adam Weishaupt for encouraging atheism. Scottish scientist John Robison produced the second work, titled Proofs of a Conspiracy, which alleged that the Illuminati laid the groundwork for the French Revolution by infiltrating and manipulating Masonic lodges and reading societies, which is precisely what Illuminati founder Weishaupt said this should do. Robison and Barruel arrived separately at their conclusions. However, Robison got much of his information from a Catholic monk and British secret agent named Alexander Horn. That's led some to conjecture that both books were part of a Vatican-inspired plot to discredit the French Revolution. Others see the hidden hand of the British government, then at war with revolutionary France. Is there any evidence of an Illuminati role in the French Revolution? Yes, though it's hardly conclusive. In 1785, an Italian adventurer, Count Alessandro Cagliostro, popped up in Paris. Born Giuseppe Balsamo, the Count earned a reputation as an esoteric Freemason and wonder worker. He was expelled from England and Russia for fraud. Cagliostro visited Germany in 1777, right after the founding of the Illuminati. There, Cagliostro reportedly met Weishaupt, and, like Weishaupt, was initiated into something called the Strict Observance Masonic Rite. At his later trial in Rome, Cagliostro claimed to be an Illuminati, but he also claimed to be a Knight Templar. In Paris, Cagliostro had created a new Masonic rite, the Egyptian, which he touted to be true Freemasonry. It later became the Rite of Memphis and Mizraim, which attracted radical and nonconformists across Europe. Cagliostro and his Egyptian rite became all the rage. He even admitted women. He also became chums with the Duke of Orléans and other prominent Freemasons. But Cagliostro made enemies as well. He became implicated, probably unjustly, in the so-called Affair of the Diamond Necklace. It's been called a preface to the French Revolution. Basically, it was a con game that targeted French Queen Marie Antoinette. She was innocent of any real wrongdoing, but the scandal generated bad press for the already shaky monarchy. In 1786, Cagliostro ended up in jail in the Bastille. Demonstrations organized by his Masonic supporters eventually secured his release. Cagliostro later wrote an open letter to the French people, urging them to mount a peaceful revolution and destroy the Bastille. So, some believe the Duke of Orléans and Desmoulins were following Cagliostro's instructions when they targeted the old fortress in 1789. Cagliostro's fatal mistake was in returning to Italy and trying to set up a Masonic lodge in Rome. The Vatican caught him, and he lived out his last years in prison. But there are other Illuminati links. In 1787, 2 years before the revolution exploded, Weishaupt's nominal replacement at the head of the Bavarian Illuminati, Johann Bode, made 2 trips to Paris. In Paris, Bode formed a close relationship with the radical publisher and future Jacobin I just mentioned, Nicolas Bonnefille. And Bonnefille subsequently wrote what some considered an Illuminati Manifesto on World Revolution. Bonneville was a Freemason and pals with both the Duke of Orléans and revolutionary firebrand Camille Desmoulins. Plus, Bonneville and Desmoulins belong to yet another secret organization, the Society of the Friends of Truth. It was described as a combination of political club, Masonic lodge, and literary salon. Just the sort of thing that Adam Weishaupt might have ordered. What about America? Was there Illuminati influence there? That's what the minister G.W. Snyder asked George Washington in 1798. In his reply, Washington didn't doubt that the doctrines of Illuminism and the principles of Jacobinism had found their way to America. But Washington said he didn't believe that the lodges of Freemasons in this country had, as societies, endeavored to propagate such ideas. But Washington feared that some individual Masons were guilty of doing so, and he singled out the so-called Democratic Republican societies I mentioned earlier. Washington also regarded radical pamphleteer Tom Paine as one of those pernicious individuals. So, did secret societies play a role in the American and French revolutions? Like feathers on a goose. But feathers, of course, aren't the whole goose. The real question might be whether the revolutions in America and France could have ever taken place at all without the participation of secret societies.